know what's going on.
Me either. Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Sutai Vampir and Jajim Vestai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome, warriors, to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
And, yes. And today, we are going to look at Star Trek Log 7, entitled The Counterclock Incident by Alan Dean Foster, published in June of 1976.
Now, you might ask, why are we looking at a book that is written about episodes from the animated series? Well, in this particular case, the first little over a third of the book is the episode, but the last two-thirds of the book are a totally different tale from anything that was in the animated series.
Now, this was the last episode of the animated series. Number 11, by the same title, The Counterclock Incident. So, John, why don't you give us a brief summary of the plot?
Well, I see that in your additions to it, we've got two different synopses on the back of the books. Mainly because, well, I've got the 1976 printing of the book, and you've got the 2006 printing.
Right.
So, on the back of the book that I've got, it says, Commodore Robert April, the first captain of the Enterprise, was traveling at warp speeds towards retirement, a fate worse than death for a seasoned sailor of the spaceways. God, this is trite to read. There didn't seem to be any way to turn back the hands of time. Precursor of what's going to happen, guys. But then, nothing is ever certain in the outer reaches of the galaxy. Nothing, that is, except that a Klingon in pursuit means trouble. Especially when that Klingon is the Commander Komara, who, up until now, we've never heard of before.
Nope, never have.
So, Jim, why don't you go ahead and read the back of your volume?
It will do. Now, this volume, published in 2006 by Del Rey, contains two episodes from the animated series. And so the first one is Counterclock Incident. The Enterprise's first captain, Commodore Robert April, is aboard the starship one last time en route to his retirement ceremonies. On the way back, Kirk attempts to save an alien ship headed straight for the Beta Niobe Nova. Instead, the Enterprise plunges through the heart of the Nova and into an alternative universe where everything runs backward. Day is night, stars are black, not white, and time flows into the past as people get younger with every breath they take.
Did Alan rewrite the book?
I don't believe he did.
Because Robert April was... They encountered this Nova. They encountered this ship that took them into the Nova. April was still on board.
Well, yeah. He was being taken to Babel, where they were going to have his retirement ceremony.
Yeah, it's just... I don't know, when you were reading it, it sounded like the incidents took place after they dropped him off. And I hate to say it, what was the other episode that he included? Because there was only the one episode in the volume I've got.
To be completely honest, I didn't even look at it. So it was whatever whatever log 8 would be.
Okay, so they draw. I've got log 8.
Yeah, they put 2 volumes in each, new reprinting in 2006. The thing that I think is really notable about both of these summaries is that neither one mentions anything about the second 2/3 of this story by Alan Dean Foster.
Actually, the 1976 version did, in that nothing that is except a Klingon in pursuit means trouble.
Right. And that didn't happen right away, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. So, do you have any overall impressions you'd like to put out there?
Overall impressions. It's interesting that the first part of the book, where they go into the negative universe, to me, read like an animated series episode. Then, when they got to the Klingon encounter in the last part of the book, that read like a original series episode. The writing felt different. Now, that could be that I had watched the animated episode and, you know, got those kind of vibes from it. But it just seemed weird that you had a different feel in the two different parts of the book to me.
I agree with that.
So it's not just me.
No, not at all. I mean,
it's not just that I watched the episode and was tainted by the experience.
I rewatched the episode of the same name before I read the story and thought it was a little hokey, as many of the episodes of the animated series were, in my humble opinion anyway. I have to say that the author did a pretty good job fleshing out the original story, making it a bit more believable.
Well, you see, that's the problem with the animated series. It was a half hour, and they're trying to do an hour-long idea from Star Trek in a half-hour time spot. So a lot of things got truncated and thrown out the window. If you want to see an even starker example of this, around this same time, there was a series of vinyl, of record albums of Star Trek stories with the cast members. And they were only about 10 to 15 minutes long in an episode.
Oh, boy.
So they got truncated even more.
Huh.
Yeah, I think that's what it was, is the animated series was truncated. It should have been an hour long to tell the story they were trying to tell. But by this point, it became, you know, all about the money.
Yeah, also, I'll say, before I read the book, I read Foster's introduction, which is included, I guess, in the 06 volume, but not in the 76 volume.
Nope, it was not in the 76 version.
Yeah. Anyway, it explained how the second part of this story came about. According to him, the second part of the story came from a movie script that he pitched to Roddenberry's Norway Productions Company. He got the script back with a note to save it for the fourth season of the original series, of course, and we know that never happened.
Almost. We almost got Phase 2, but Star Wars came out and changed everything.
The publisher, Del Rey, contacted him to novelize the Counterclock incident, and he wondered how he was going to flesh out a 20-page script for the animated series into a 60,000-word novella when he remembered that he had this unused script. So anyway, in the introduction, he wrote this. So here I was sitting in my apartment in Santa Monica, wondering how to get a novel out of 20 pages of teleplay, and it struck me that I had 120 pages of a Star Trek teleplay stuffed in a file cabinet doing nothing but gathering dust. An unused 120 pages of a Star Trek teleplay. Reworked and rewritten, that teleplay became the last 2/3 of Log 7, while the adaptation and expansion of the single TV episode, The Counterclock Incident, formed the first 1/3 of the book. So, I'll tell you what, foreknowledge of what Foster did to bring the two stories together helped to make a little more sense of the book and the ending, which I agree is a distinct parallel of Errand of Mercy, as you had pointed out. The major difference is that the entities who intervened in this treatment were observing an experiment they had set up. So in other words, they were observing human and Klingon behavior. They were apparently higher beings, but they were actually manipulating things to get reactions.
So what I'm getting from this and other Star Trek things is there's at least four races of higher beings, because you've got the aliens from Errand of Mercy.
Organians.
You got the Wanderers. Well, they're only Organians because that's the name of the planet.
Yeah.
We don't know what their real name is. We got the Wanderers from here. We've got the parents of the Squire of Gothos. And we've got Q.
Yeah.
Well, how many more of these guys are there?
Let's not forget the Travelers from Next Generation.
Yeah, that's true. Can't forget them either. There's five.
So,
And you got Wesley now as one of those Travelers.
Now, if we put our heads together and thought about it, we could probably come up with a few more.
Question is, why does Star Trek not reuse them? Okay, once they came up with Q, a lot of times, because people liked that particular character.
Mm-hmm.
But you never saw the Wanderers show up. You never saw the Organians show up. The Travelers showed up a couple of times, and that was about it. But if they're going to be there, and if they're going to play games with humans, then we ought to see those games.
That's one of the reasons that Q became so popular, is because he did come back from time to time to check in and cause Picard more grief.
No, I think Q came back and became popular because Delancey made his character just so bizarre.
Well, okay, and now this is going way off topic, but if you ever look at the series My Little Pony,
Delancey... I probably won't.
You probably won't, but... Delancey voiced a character in My Little Pony called Discord. And Discord, honest to goodness, is Q.
Yeah, well, with a name like Discord, you gotta cause trouble.
It's amazing. My daughter, she likes My Little Pony. I probably know way more about it than I should, but she played all the Discord episodes for me, and I'll tell you what, John Delancey in both of them, he is Q all the way through. So I just thought I'd throw that in. I suppose we ought to get on with this. So we've got all the characters. We have Lieutenant Arex added, because Walter Koenig was not invited back to voice. His character is Chekhov, so he was replaced by a character named Arex, and I can't recall what his species was, but he wasn't human.
No, he has three arms. In fact, Star Trek Phase 2, in one of the last few vignettes that they made, actually went ahead and CGI'd him into a live-action version of their show.
And we have Commodore April, who is 75 years old, which is mandatory retirement for Starfleet, and they're ferrying him to Babel for his retirement ceremony. He's not looking for it. His wife is with him on board the ship. We have other characters that come in at different points, in and out. Now, I thought Foster's treatment of the first, of the episode, the TV episode, I thought was right on. I thought it was very well done. It was fleshed out enough to be far more enjoyable than the episode on television was, and better able to understand.
Yeah, when I was watching the episode on television, my thought was, why the hell are the Aprils getting in the transporter to go back to being 75? Well, Foster doesn't put him back in the transporter, doesn't send them back to being 75. So they get to not relive, but get those years to live how they want, differently.
And then, but in the TV show, they send them back through the transporter because April says, I wouldn't change a thing. And there's no reason for us to go back and become younger again.
But let me stop you there. The reason they go through the transporter, the reason they go back to being 75 is the unwritten rule of Star Trek. Everything must be the same at the end of the episode as it started with in the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. But also, okay, here's one of the little problems I have. When they went to the alternate universe, they began de-aging. They began going backwards, but also all of their knowledge that they had accumulated was also incrementally being lost.
Well, I think a little of that is the fact that as you're younger, you haven't got the brain cells put in the right places yet. Until you're age 25, your brain is still forming. So that could be going away. But what got me is Commodore April was 75, yet Spock was younger than he was right before they escaped from the negative universe.
Uh-huh.
And it was stated in an earlier episode of Star Trek, the original series, that Spock was 99 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Oops. Spock should have been older.
Well, at any rate, Spock did age less rapidly than the rest of the crew.
De-age.
Yeah. De-age, yes, there we go.
He just had more years to de-age.
Yeah.
That's why I'm thinking Spock should have been older than Robert April towards the end.
Mm-hmm. So at any rate, it went right along with the script from the TV show, fleshed out, and that was the first third of the book. And now we get into this story that involves Klingons. And we have a very interesting Klingon character in Commander Kumara,
who apparently is majorly known to Kirk, but we have never, and we're supposed to know who this guy is, and he's never been introduced in Star Trek lore up till now.
We were supposed to know who he was.
For God's sakes, he was Kirk's roommate.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, Kumara referred to him as Jim.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
because they knew each other really well.
I would say that the way they behaved towards each other in this story is they were friendly, but they weren't friends.
No, I can understand that. What kind of threw me out was Kumara has this Klingon ship, top of the line vessel, but he's got no respect for any of his crew. Why could he not find members of the Klingon race that he could deal with and have on his crew? He treated all of them like idiots.
Yeah. Well, and basically a lot of them behaved like idiots.
Which means you get rid of those guys and get somebody who isn't.
Get a better crew. I think what Foster was trying to do with Kumara was actually make him a super Klingon.
Yeah, you kind of got that impression, but even there's still some semi-super or looking towards getting super, or I've at least got an advanced degree.
Yeah.
That could have been friends with Kumara and been on his ship. He should have actively recruited that type of an individual.
Well, they were probably all running around. The real good Klingons were all running around with Kang, Koloth, and Kor.
Yeah, well, if Kumara is such a super duper individual. Maybe they should have been running around with him. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's not unprecedented, because in the Star Trek movies, okay, the search for Spock, Commander Krug was way far more intelligent than anyone else on board the ship, and his officers were kind of doofy.
Yeah.
Even his first officer was saying, "Oh boy, you know, they can make planets. Isn't that wonderful?" And Krug looked at him like, what kind of an idiot are you? This is a weapon. This is not something that, you know, we want the Federation to have. We need to get this.
Well, remember, the Federation was saying it's not a weapon. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm not gonna fault his crew. His crew was a step above Lieutenant Krit and the rest of them.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, they were just convenient. And at the time that this book was written, Klingons were stock characters. They were just villains.
Klingons were commies.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. But they were, you had very, very intelligent Klingons, Kag, Kor, Koloth, and now Kumara.
But one of the things that really bothered me about the first segment and the second segment was warp speed. Okay? They're running, they encounter Carla Five from the negative universe as she's trying to go back through the Nova and get back to her own universe. And she's doing warp 35.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're detecting something doing warp 35, which my understanding is the speed of light to the 35th power.
Uh-huh.
You're detecting it. It's gone. Well, where'd it go? Don't know.
Yeah.
It's gone.
I couldn't imagine detecting something traveling at that speed.
It's just a blip in history. I mean, you wouldn't even know. You wouldn't even have the chance to figure out anything that it was made of.
Yeah.
And then that gets us back to the second half of the book, where they start trying to do little things with emergency power and, okay, we've got our warp thing back. Let's do some stuff. And okay, we're gonna snap the whip on these guys. And wait a minute, you're talking about things at multiples of the speed of light. It's gonna be blink and you missed it.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, if they were doing, if the Klingon stuff was being interacted at sublight speed, on impulse power, okay, fine. You can keep up with that. But if you're dealing with warp, you put things in a warp bubble and you're sending them through at warp, it's blinking, you missed it. Sorry.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to detect that.
Let alone hang on to it with a tractor rope.
Yeah. So, you know, even in the with the negative universe, did you happen to notice the name of the planet?
No, until you put it on, down here on the thing, I didn't notice that it was Terra backwards.
Yeah, Aret, and it was Terra backwards. I thought that was kind of funny.
Okay, but what that tells you, having read the entire book and gone through the whole thing and know who the Wanderers, Carla Five, and everybody else actually are and what it actually is, it shows that they are not imaginative.
True.
See what I mean?
True.
I mean, what their home planet, what do they name it? Well, they're dealing with Terran, so let's just call it Terra backwards, because that's how we speak. We totally speak backwards.
See, and as I read, of course, as I read the first part of this, the from the script for the TV show, I noticed that, yeah, that sounds, or that reads backwards, exactly what the message should be.
Yeah.
I'm not good at anagram puzzles, but that one at least I could figure out.
Well, the thing is, in the TV show, it's hard to figure that out. But reading it in the novel, having the words in front of you and the letters in front of you, it's fairly easy to see what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, you're seeing all over Facebook, they're putting out these things of a statement. It's always the same statement. If you can read this, then you're of the top utter intelligence that nobody else can match or anything like that. And
yeah.
it's written backwards, and it gets to the point where you can just read the words backwards. You don't even have to interpret them.
That's all silliness anyway, but
I mean, it's like the call signs they have, you know, Tango, Foxtrot, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I've seen those too.
You do a couple of them and all, you know, you can just all of a sudden start reading them.
Yeah.
You don't have to translate. So
yeah.
But that's not Alan's fault.
No.
That's what it was in the script.
Yeah, and he has to follow the script and flesh it out. And so that was the first third of the story. There was a few things, though, now in the second part of the story that I had to think about. You know, at first, I was a little confused by the use of Klingonese as opposed to Klingon whole.
But remember, this was back, I think this is probably even before the final reflection.
Yeah, well, see, and that, I realized that. You know, the work was published 30 years before the copy I got. And when I realized that, then it was like, oh, well, okay, now I understand that. Because by 2006, Klingon whole was a standard.
Because it wasn't until Star Trek III that Mark had designed the Klingon language.
And, you know, there were also a few things that were a little off in the story. For instance, Kirk was wearing a chronometer disguised as a ring.
That didn't bother me.
And a translator in the form of a necklace.
If a necklace was male fashion wear, that'd be a great place to put it.
Yeah, but at the same time, they have those already inserted, don't they?
In some stories, yeah, they're embedded in their arm. You know, you've got a couple of stories where McCoy is injecting the universal translator into I think Romulans, to be exact, to get them to understand Federation speak.
So anyway, the one huge thing that I think needed to be added into this book, and he could have probably gotten another 20 pages out of it, was McCoy complaining to high heaven about having to spend time aboard a Klingon vessel.
God, how the hell did they keep him from being shot?
Yeah. I mean, you can just imagine what McCoy would have to say.
He complains about everything.
When he gets back, yeah. And he did anyway in the book, but I mean, we never got a rant from McCoy about his time aboard a Klingon ship.
Now, I don't know what the original series Klingon ships were. The animated series Klingon ships seem to be a lot brighter on the inside than the next generation Klingon ships. So, which of course would have given Alan a chance to talk about Klingon ships if he had wanted to use that.
We didn't spend a great deal of time on the Klathys, which was the name of the Klingon ship.
But I think Alan was limited by how many words or how many pages he could spend telling this tale. All of the Star Trek log books are about the same length.
Yeah, about 175 pages.
I got about 182 in mine. But yeah, it's right in there. It's right in there. 175, 182. In the publishing world, that ain't much. Ain't much of a difference.
So, and then one more thing that I had to think about was the whole idea, and this is from the first part of the story, from the counterclock incident part of it, the whole idea of someone being born as an elderly adult and aging backwards caused me to become disturbed. I didn't even want to think about that.
Merlin.
Yeah. Well, but Merlin had magic. This is, I mean, yuck. I don't even want to think about it.
The Wanderers had magic too, if you think about it, because any sufficiently advanced science is magic.
Well, that's true.
And besides, we don't know if that was the case. That was just what they said to fit in with where they threw them. The TV episode didn't go into the, well, this might not be exactly the way things are, because we're kind of running you guys through this maze to see how you rats act to it. But
yeah, so we have some adventures to discuss. I think we covered the Aprils pretty well from the beginning, and you know, that's pretty cut and dried. They're headed to retirement. Robert April does not want to retire, but he's being forced to. They go off on this sidetracked mission to help these people. They help them get back to their own universe. Everybody goes through the transporter and becomes themselves again after de-aging to the point where the ship almost couldn't function anymore.
Well, the ship could function, but the personnel in the ship didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah, they slowly lost their knowledge of.
They're not. Yeah.
Yeah, and
now the question. Here's a question for you, though.
Uh-huh.
Did the Federation change the retirement policy, or what's going on? Because at the beginning of the Next Generation series, Admiral McCoy, still active in the Federation, is 111.
Yeah.
Which, now that I say that, sounds kind of interesting, because how old was Bilbo when he took off?
Yeah. Yeah.
111.
True. Yeah. Well, see, now, at the end of the television episode Counterclock Incident, Kirk tells April that the policy has been changed and April is not going to have to retire.
Well, he actually tells them that the policy is being looked at again.
Yeah.
And he may not have to retire.
Yeah. Well, you know how that's going to go. So instead of going to Babel as a retirement ceremony, he's probably just going there for some kind of a celebration eventually. But as you say, in the book, there's no real definitive answer there other than that April and his wife decide not to go through the transporter.
And they're like 30 years younger.
And yeah, and so he no longer has to retire. So that's kind of how they handle that.
Well, now that's a legalistic question that should have been looked at. Okay, Robert April is 30 years younger than the 75 years he has on his birth certificate.
Uh-huh.
But if you're looking at mandatory retirement ages, you go by the birth certificate. He may be physically 45 years old, but legally he's still 75 years old. Which do you go by? You're wasting resources if you throw him out, but you're following the law if you do throw him out.
But you know something? At the age of 45, going from 75 to 45, in this particular instance, he has also lost all of the experience and knowledge that he gained during those 30 years.
Did he? I got the feeling that the Aprils didn't lose any of their knowledge. Frankly, that the crew didn't start losing any of their knowledge until they hit their teenage years. And then the memories started degrading.
Well, their ability to function was degrading.
Well, if you, some of the things, you're talking with Sulu, talking with Kirk, and eventually talking with Spock, they were starting to lose their cognitive functions as they hit those lower years, but not until they got below that. I guess 25 would be the cutoff, I would think, because that's supposed to be when the human brain is fully functional, has gotten all of its stuff to work with. So before that, they may not be able to hang on to it. I don't know.
Well, maybe we just have a huge plot hole here.
Yes. That's what I say. You miss the opportunity to nitpick the legalese of retirement, and then you've got the plot hole on how much of your memory do you retain as you de-age. If it's your body de-aging, then you're not going to lose the memories until your brain could no longer process them. And what's Star Trek without plot holes?
So in the second two-thirds of the story, the Enterprise gets called to escort a brother and sister scientist team and a weapon they developed to a Federation outpost away from the Klingon border. What were their names?
Oh, I've got it written here. Van and Char, unpronounceable. Delminin.
Delminin. Yeah, that's right.
But I didn't think they were close to the Klingon border, because I got the feeling, I got the impression that Kermara had to bring his ship way inside. That when he was trying to get back to get reinforcements, it was going to take a while because they were nowhere near a Klingon base where they could get reinforcements. But it couldn't have been near the neutral zone because there was no talk about a violation of the neutral zone treaty.
No, there wasn't. None at all. We get this brother and sister scientific team, the Delminans, and they have supposedly developed a method for breaking apart solid objects in space up to the size of planets. And they've already tested this. And that, of course, is going to make the Klingons rather nervous. So the Klingons decide they're going to go in and kidnap these people and take them back and get all the knowledge they can from them to develop their own weapon, while Starfleet wants them out of the picture and wants them to come home so they can be controlled, okay? And Van Delminen knows this, and he doesn't want anything to do with anybody. The only thing he wants is to be left alone on his planet to do his thing and get this done. Well, as it would happen, everybody meets up on the planet, and Van gets picked up by the Klingons, while his sister, Char, gets picked up by Kirk.
Through a transporter mishap.
Now, the funny thing is the Klingons figure, well, we got him. He's the mastermind behind this, but actually, all he did was come up with the concept, and his sister is the one who developed the device and knows everything there is to know about the engineering of it.
Well, remember, the Federation, Kirk, and the Enterprise thought the same thing.
Yeah, well, everybody thought that Van, just assuming he's the male, he's the genius that came up with this, and then they find out that Char is actually the one, and it becomes more of a rescue mission to get her brother back, Char's brother back, Van, and then get out.
But here's the question. Is that really the case? You know why? The Wanderers, they're Wanderers. This particular Van and Char are Wanderers. They're not the real ones. The real ones are off somewhere else. Kirk and his bud, Klingon bud, come in and kidnap Wanderers. So this could be a Wanderer's gimmick to keep the Klingons and the Federation together to see how they'll react.
Well, we get this running battle in space, and both ships are more or less disabled. Nobody can go anywhere.
More or less. They're spending weeks and weeks trying to get their drive system going again. That's a long, long time. Scotty usually does it in 4 hours, sir, and gets it done an hour later.
Right, and that's exactly what I was thinking, too. I mean, we have Scotty on board. It should take a matter of minutes for him to get things working again, but, of course, that doesn't happen. Scotty's just as baffled as everybody else is to get his ship running again, and the Klingons, apparently their engineers, aren't doing any better. But out of nowhere appears this planet that is a wandering planet, and the Enterprise crew decides to call it Gypsy because it's just moving through space there, and it doesn't have a sun, of course. But conveniently, there are energy discharges on the planet that create light.
Even Space 1999 didn't have light.
No. Now, I don't know if it was intentional or not, but this is where Alan Dean Foster really started a parallel with Errand of Mercy.
There's another one, too, but he couldn't have started a parallel with it because it wasn't written for another 20 years, and that is The Search for Spock. What is the device that the brother and sisters put together, if not a Genesis-like device? It's not going to create planets, but it's going to do the first part.
Well, it'll break them apart to make it easier to mine.
And the Genesis was, you break it apart to put the pieces together in the way you want.
Yeah, set up a livable planet.
But we can't accuse Alan of stealing that, because he's like 20 years ahead of the movie.
Yeah. Kumara and Kirk decide they're going to have a little contest and go down to the planet, and whoever wins gets the prize, which is the scientist.
And like you say, this is where it starts getting like Errand of Mercy, because I swear that planet is just like the Organians were. It's described just like the Organians were in Errand of Mercy.
15th century, very little, if any, technology. And they have to put on native clothing to go down, you know, of course, to cover themselves with the Prime Directive. And they go down there, and yeah, people talk strange, and they behave strangely, and they have strange rules, and there's buildings and places to stay. You know, everything's going along just very well till the very end, where they come out and say, nope, that's enough. You guys are done. Your the object, or the Delmenans, are not going to they're not real. They're one of us, and we're superior, and we've been playing games with you just to see how you behave.
Which is almost surprising that Kirk didn't come out and say, wait a minute, you can't tell us we can't fight each other. If we want to fight each other, we can fight each other.
Yeah, we didn't get all of that. But yeah, it does smack of Errand of Mercy quite a bit.
So it's surprising that Alan was saying that he had written this as a movie treatment to be used. Well, then again, didn't Alan write the plot treatment they used for Star Trek the Motion Picture?
Oh, you got me at a disadvantage.
Okay, I'm pretty sure he did. And again, it was for Phase 2. But they grabbed it and they used it to do the movie. And let's face it, that is the Nomad story.
Yes, it is. On a much larger scale.
Bigger budget.
Wow, we got a lot of tie-ins here.
Yeah, well, I think Alan was doing that a lot. I think that, you know, he's been used to, up till now, most of his writing was not original universes. Most of his writing was either Star Wars or Star Trek. He novelized at least A New Hope, and then wrote the, I can't remember the name of the book, but it's the direct sequel to A New Hope that came out in book form before Empire Strikes Back was made.
Mm.
And then, like I say, he did all these Star Trek log books, so he was cutting his teeth in the industry, working on shared universes.
Oh, yeah. And Alan Dean Foster today is one of those authors that if you see his name on it, you know it's going to be something you would like to read. Because he does a great job of novelizing stories that have been told.
He does have his own stuff, too. His Flint's books. F-L-I-N-X. Pip and Flint's books. He's got like 8 to 10 of those now. They're his own universe.
So, yeah, he's a very prolific and an awesome writer, and I enjoy his stuff immensely.
You won't be disappointed in one of his books, or you'll be disappointed in all of his books because you're just not that type of a reader.
So, now we have some concepts here to talk about. The honor and trustworthiness of a Klingon's word. Now, Kumara gives his word to Kirk, that he is not going to cheat during their contest.
Think about this for a second. Nowhere in the original series has the word of a Klingon been accepted as binding, as acceptable. But here, Kamara gives his word. I forget what it is he gave his word on. And Kirk accepted it as gospel. And Kamara did not violate that oath.
So now, the concept of Klingon honor, what year did that come up? Was that before 1976?
I don't know. I don't think that in Star Trek media, non-book form, we saw anything about Klingon honor until the Next Generation, until Worf, until the other Klingons showed up on the Enterprise and you had Worf interacting with them. Yeah, I don't think it showed up until later on.
So this could be the dawn of the concept of Klingons having
yes.
honor and fleshed out and made real.
Yeah, I think that's the case here. And you only see it because we're looking back. We're not reading this in 1976. We're reading this after Star Trek Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen all the Klingon honor stuff. We know it's there. But in 76, it wasn't.
And of course, before, during the original series, there was no such thing as Klingon honor.
They were devious. They were untrustworthy. They were going to pull whatever they could pull to get their mission accomplished.
Absolutely. David Gerald even said, you know, wrote about what Klingons are in his book, Making of Star Trek, and he described them as ruthless, warrior race, and you wouldn't want to spend much time with a Klingon because they're the kind of person that would fart in an airlock.
I'm afraid that if you gotta go, you gotta go. Hey, I'm in an airlock. Oh my God, I feel it coming. I feel it coming. How soon are we going to get out of this airlock?
No, a Klingon.
I can't hold it much more.
Apparently, Klingons can flatulate on demand.
Oh, okay.
Whenever they want to, I guess.
He did it first.
I guess. I don't know. So, what I picked up out of this book is that it's very strong with, at the end of this book, a concept that the idea of reality is an illusion, and illusions have a tendency to become reality.
It depends on how much power you've got. If you remember Forbidden Planet, that was the whole basis of why Krell died off. Their subconscious id kind of took over and generated the fantasy realities that they were dreaming about, and they weren't very safe realities. But, you know, you're dealing with the Squire of Gothos' kid. You're seeing him do it there. The Organians, you know, they could do things. We don't know how far they could go. They could do them. The Wanderers, you know, they've set this up. Q snaps his fingers all the time. So, again, any sufficiently advanced science becomes magic, and magic can turn that illusion into a reality to an extent.
I think actually Alan Dean Foster was trying to get us to think about our lives. Are we living reality? Is this a reality, or are we living in somebody's holodeck simulation?
Now, he didn't steal that one either, because Saint Elsewhere's was a series later on.
Yeah, no, I think it's more of a something to cause a person to think rather than suggesting that reality is an illusion. However, there are a lot of people who live in reality and are living an illusion.
Well, to an extent, you're probably right that reality can be an illusion if you take into account Schrodinger's cat.
Go on.
Okay, you know the story of Schrodinger's cat?
Yeah, vaguely.
Cat's locked in a box. Cat's locked in a box. And you don't know if the cat is alive or dead. So the cat is actually both alive and dead until you open the box and observe the phenomena.
Okay.
So if the cat is dead, but you don't know it, then it is an illusion. If the cat is alive and you haven't observed that yet and think the cat is dead, then it is an illusion to you that the cat is dead.
Okay.
Schrodinger's point of view was, until you observe the phenomena is both.
Okay. I can see that. But I don't think we're living in the Matrix.
Okay. This is pre-Matrix. It's just, it gets back to the electron. You can either know how fast the electron is moving, or you can know where the electron is, but you can't know both.
Ah.
That's a quantum mechanics thing. And since we don't know how it can be done, but since then we have found out that if you take an electron pair and divide the pair up at the point that they've been divided up, they are both spinning in the opposite direction of each other. If you change the spin of one, no matter how far away it is from the other spin will flip to match, and they'll still both be spinning in the opposite direction. They call that quantum entanglement. So there's a lot we don't know. There's a lot of science out there that can make reality out of an illusion. We're just not there yet.
No, long way to go. So anyway, do you have any favorite points of plot?
Yeah, where's my flying car?
I don't know. We aren't doing too well with the ones that just run on the ground, I'll tell you what. So I don't know if I'm ready for a flying car.
Yeah, they've talked about what's going to happen if they ever come up with a flying car. How are you going to keep traffic lanes sufficiently focused to keep from having all kinds of accidents? So
yeah, exactly.
That's beside the point.
I mean, you remember what Coruscant looks like with all that stuff flying around.
Hey, take it a step further. You want to see some congestion, not Coruscant, but the Fifth Element.
Oh yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, there you've got some congestion going on.
Oh geez, scary.
But this is a fairly short book, and you really only have two things going on in it, and that is the animated series episode and the Klingon part that comes after it. I'm going to have to go with the Klingon part that comes after it, because I'd seen the counterclock incident already, and Komara and the Klingon part of it is something new that I haven't dealt with before. That's going to be my choice.
I completely agree. I liked the second part. The first part, okay, it was nice, and the way it got tied together at the end was nice. But I would have liked to have seen this particular Klingon character, Komara, depicted in a live series at some point, because he seemed to have real insight on how humans think, and also struck me as a melding of between Kang, Kor, and Koloth. And it really intrigued me how Kumara and Kirk knew each other well enough that Kumara called Kirk by his first name numerous times throughout the book. And Kirk didn't bat an eye at that at all. I'd like to see more on that story.
And what kind of bothered me about the situation where you got these two starships, Federation and Klingon, sitting nose to nose out in space for weeks at a time, trying to get themselves repaired. Did neither Kirk nor Koromar think of setting up a attack team to go EVA and board the other ship?
No, not at all.
We tend to, when we narrow focus on what we're trying to get to, we tend to forget the obvious things.
Yeah, but there was that agreement between Kumara and Kirk that they weren't going to do...
That came later.
...those things.
That came later.
I mean...
That came later.
I'm
talking about right after they've been disabled, and they're sitting there in space, and they're not even talking to each other. And this thing is so desperate. They've got to get the siblings together somehow.
Right.
You got to figure something out to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the same time, if you follow that string of logic, why not just, when you pull up in front of an enemy ship, just beam a photon torpedo on board the enemy ship and blow them up?
It might not be enough. I've always thought that if you're going to do that, you beam an anti-mat device over and drop its containment and poof, you got them.
Well, exactly. And it would make real short episodes and real short books.
Yeah.
And
you
no.
See, it gets back to Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell. One time we're talking about a novel they were going to write about an invasion of Earth by an alien species.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's the best way to soften the planet up so you can just come right in and take over? You drop a rock on them. Now, let's face it, every other alien invasion thing is you're going to go in with tech. You're going to go in with guns blazing. Why does nobody ever drop the damn rock?
Well, you know what? Babylon 5 did.
Well, that's only after Larry and Jerry wrote Lucifer's Hammer.
You know, I've downloaded that book on your recommendation, and I'm just waiting for a chance to read it. So.
Yeah. Like I say, that book started out as an alien invasion book and ended up being a disaster book.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to reading it at some point. So let's get into our themes. We have trust.
And not the type you get at a bank.
No, not that kind. But it seemed like Kirk was absolutely on board with Kumara, ready to trust him on his word.
He had dealt with Kumara many more years than he had dealt with the other three Klingons that we see in the TV series.
Yeah, but you see, Kang, Kor, and Koloth never made any promises. They never made an oath to Kirk, with the possible exception of Kang, who, you know, agreed to drop arms.
Stop fighting.
And stop fighting. And, of course, then we have to assume that Kang, rather than being taken prisoner, was sent home.
Yeah, I kind of got the feeling he was dropped off at some Klingon base or some place that he could get back to the Klingon Empire.
Yeah.
But yeah, trust was not an issue that you dealt with, that you thought about dealing with Klingons up until this point in any of the episodes of Star Trek.
Yeah, this is a whole new concept. So as we said earlier, it may be the dawn of Klingon honor.
Yeah.
I mean, even in the original series, Kalos was a creep.
In the original series.
Yeah.
But in the original series, Kalos was an amalgamation of what the humans thought Kalos was.
Or that species of, or that rock species that brought him back for that contest.
They took all those people out of the humans' minds to make for that contest.
Yeah, so...
Otherwise, why would there be an Abraham Lincoln?
Yeah, that's very true.
I'm sorry, he's not that important that an alien race thousands of light years away from Gettysburg is going to even know who he is.
Yeah, that's very true. That's good logic. So, how two twins can make each other whole.
We don't go into this much, but... It's been gone into some in other works of fiction of how two beings can complement each other enough so that you get one entity that is a functional entity
mm-hmm.
out of two flawed entities. Although you get, in this place, you get the feeling that Char could have existed on her own without Van.
Yeah, so it seemed. Yes, absolutely. However, the whole thing, that whole concept got blown out of the water at the end when we found out that they were only illusions.
It's an illusion.
Of the real people.
Yeah.
What is a weapon?
So I'm pretty sure they were exaggerating that. Yeah, what is a weapon? If a mining device can be thought of as a weapon, if a terraforming machine, the Genesis device, can be thought of as a weapon, then what is a weapon?
A weapon is...
How many murder mysteries hinge on somebody picking up a shovel and whacking somebody across the head?
Yeah, or a hammer.
It's a weapon.
A hammer or a screwdriver or anything else. I imagine a weapon, if you need a weapon, anything that's handy could be considered a weapon.
But in this case, how far do you go to deny your enemy a weapon? I think that's what we're looking at here. Except again, it's an illusion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think when we got done with the story, the 9th and 10th planet of the system that the twins were actually in had not been destroyed.
Mm-hmm. So you have roommates here. I think we talked about that. Kirk and Kumara. Bureaucratic retirement. We haven't gotten too far into that one. And you know what?
We haven't?
No, not really. I'm just really glad that I get to retire before I turn 75.
Yeah. Well, right now, the quote, retirement age is, in your case, I think 67.
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
But because of half of our Congress, it's not a mandatory age. Yet, it is a mandatory age because the places that you work for are going to mandate that you do that in subtle ways. That's not a bureaucratic dictate, but we're going to throw you out the door.
Yeah. Now, as I understand, and I hope I'm not opening up old wounds, you were forced to retire before you wanted to.
Yeah, I was planning on working until 68, but apparently they didn't want somebody who knew how a lab should be run to be in the lab because they were more interested in everybody just getting along than everybody doing things right. So it was just subtle nudges to get me out the door.
Yeah. I know you were really unhappy about that. I remember that. So.
Yeah. Well, it cut your pension back.
Well, see, and I'm going to pull the plug at 65. That's when I know that I can, hopefully, I can get Medicare, and I can actually...
No, there's no hope about it. You will.
Okay.
Unless somebody pulls the plug by cutting the payroll tax, at 65, you're cut off from the insurance that you've got now to go into Medicare.
Yeah, so that's my plan at this point. Do Klingons like games?
And I forget why I put that in there. Probably because Kumara is coming up with a game to settle the dispute.
Mm-hmm. A game rather than a battle.
Yeah.
And
the normal Klingon way is, let's duke it out. Phasers on full. Come on, we're going to blow you away. But here he comes up with a game.
Yeah. Well, and Klingons, we already know they do like games. Klinza.
Yeah. Klinza, though, remember, is going to show up in a book after this.
Mm-hmm. But we know that, if you can consider training for battle as a war game, then why would Klingons not want to participate in games, especially games of strategy?
That's if they did consider. You can consider training for battle not a war game, but a training scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to see Klingons liking games more and more as we go forward in our understanding of Klingon culture.
See, now, in my personal experience, I had convinced myself way back in high school that I was just no good at math, right? So here's here's Chrissy, my daughter, bringing home math homework that I did not think I was good at. And I got a whole different perspective trying to help her with it, because I started, rather than thinking of it as tedious work, I thought of it as puzzles to solve. And when I got to that point, it seemed to get easier.
When I was in high school, I was struggling with math until I got a one math teacher, and then all of a sudden it just turned around and math became easy for me. So easy, in fact, that when I was in college, junior year, I was taking a applied linear algebra course. And after a couple of days, I decided to skip class for the rest of the year.
Yeah.
Showed up at the end. The teacher said, you know, go ahead and try this anyway. You might do okay. I got a B for the whole course.
Neat.
Because applied linear algebra was no different than the math that I was using in analytical chemistry.
Okay.
So the problem with people learning math is, what the hell do you do with it? Well, if there's something to do with it, all of a sudden, it's piece cake. There's something you can play with it and do.
Yeah. No, and, you know, as I said, I convinced myself I was just never going to be any good at it and gave up on it. And then I started, while I was helping Chrissy, I started looking at it as more like a game or a puzzle to solve. And it actually, I learned how to do things that I refused to learn back in high school. And, you know, I wish I could go back in time and kick my ass when I was a sophomore sitting in geometry.
That's interesting, because I wish I could go back in time and buy Microsoft stock.
Well, that too.
You know, if I'm going to go back in time, I'm going to do something that's going to, you know, make my life really, really, really easy.
You have to have more money, though, right?
Yeah. So buy a stock you know is going to go way up.
Yeah.
Buy some cheap Berkshire Hathaway shares.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get our closing thoughts going here. We've been on quite a while.
Well, you think of it as a book that isn't much there, because it's a novelization of a Trek episode, but it's actually more than a novelization of a Trek episode. There's an entire story after the Trek episode that's tied in to the Trek episode, so there's a lot more here than you think.
And you know, it's funny that that's not advertised more prominently.
No, in fact, your blurb from the back of your 2006 book does not refer to it at all.
Yeah.
There's one sentence in the blurb on the back of the 1976 book, and yet that story is 2/3 of the book.
Yeah, it's insane.
Well, I guess it's a matter of, okay, they're going to remember, and they're buying this book to remember the animated series episode. So I guess that's what we've kind of got to talk about.
Well, it'll be kind of, you know, I'm going to, at some point, I'm going to read the log 8. I'll watch the episode. It goes along with it. I'll read log 8 and just see what else Foster used to flesh out the story. Because, you know, these, you get 20 minutes of TV, 22, 23, whatever it was in those days, and then you got commercials filling in. You don't have a heck of a lot of script there to work with, and you got to be right on top of your game in order to flesh something like that out into 60,000 words.
That's why they talk about most science fiction writers cut their teeth writing short stories.
Yeah.
So they know how to keep things brief, keep themselves on the point, and then when they do need to flesh out a culture in a novel, they've got the tools to do it with and keep it a very rich environment.
Yeah, culture and an environment. World building is a big part of it, too.
I was referring to the environment as the book.
Yeah.
As the words.
Yeah. So anyway, my closing thoughts. The 06 edition, you mentioned that Ballantine Books spelled Alan Dean Foster's name wrong.
Okay. Once.
Once.
But it was in the title page.
On the title page. Well, that's been corrected. You'll be happy to know.
In fact, if you want to know something else that's fun on that, A Mote in God's Eye had two typos in it in the first few editions. And every time Larry Niven would sign the book for somebody, he would flip open to those typos and correct them.
Oh.
So if you've got one of the early editions of A Mote in God's Eye signed by Larry Niven, you probably got it corrected by Larry Niven also.
There you go. Well, so anyway, you know, I was really glad to read Foster's introduction before I read the book, because these two stories would have been completely unrelated.
What the hell's going on? You know, why are they connected?
Yeah.
Tear them apart.
I even thought that as we read it, or as I read the book, it's like, wow, this is a real huge left turn
shift
at Albuquerque that just, that I could see why it would cause someone confusion. You know, I thought the ending was okay, a bit contrived. Deus ex machina.
I gotta wrap this up.
Yeah.
I mean, there's only been one other book that I've seen do something even more extreme than that.
And that would be?
There's a Robert Sheckley book about a boy and a robot. And he goes through an incredibly long tale about their life together. Until they get, I think it's in an alleyway, I could be wrong on this, but they get into an alleyway. He's written these characters into a corner. He can't figure a way to get them out of it. So the author steps out from behind the curtain and goes, I've written these characters into a corner. I can't get them out of it. So let's start this story over. And then they live happily ever after.
Which story is that?
God, I'm trying to think. It's a Robert Sheckley book.
It sounds really familiar.
Yeah, yeah. And I can't think of it now because I don't. It's been a long time since I've read Sheckley. Sheckley died a long time ago.
Okay.
But he was a really hilarious author. He did some really funny stories.
Huh. I was saying I thought the ending was okay, contrived. That being said, though, I thought it was a pretty well-written story. The characters behaved as I would expect them to, and they felt familiar. And all in all, I enjoyed it, but I'm glad it was no longer than it was.
Which is surprising, because I was going to say, maybe we'd want to see more of the Kamar Kirk conflict, because when they were doing the space battles, it was Perry faint, Perry faint, Perry. You know, they were going back and forth quite well.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were closely matched ships. So I can only assume that Kumara's ship was a D7 cruiser.
Yeah, it had to be. But I think the problem was the Wanderers were trying to wrap it up, too.
Yeah.
So not only did Alan Dean Foster have, oop, I'm getting to the end of my page limit, but the characters were going, oop, we're getting bored.
Yeah. So, well, next month, we're going to be taking a look at The Brave and the Bold, Book 2 by Keith R.A. DeCanado. And this has got a Klingon story in it with Clagg. I didn't know this existed until you told me, John.
Well, yeah. They don't spend a lot of time talking about Klingon books in the book world. It's all about Federation books, so it's kind of tough to pick them out, find them.
Yeah. So we'll be looking at that. And hey, if you're listening to this, you already know how to find us. But would you do us a favor? Number one, go out and tell your friends or anybody else you meet. Holler it from the rooftops. Stop people on the street. Tell them about us and tell them to come and listen to us. Also, you know what? A 5-star review on Apple Podcasts would be really, really nice if you have time to do that for us and if you think we deserve it.
Or if you can think of any Klingon books that we haven't done that you'd like to see us do, it would sure save us a lot of effort trying to find them.
Well, as a matter of fact, wasn't this one recommended by a listener?
Yes, it was.
So, do you remember who?
It was recommended to us by Korath from the Kansas City area.
Oh, great. Well, thank you. Thanks for the heads up and the recommendation. So you see, we will follow through on recommendations from listeners.
Now, he said he recommended this to us about a year ago. So, yeah, we'll follow through. We may forget, but because we're human and older and we tend to forget things. So you may have to remind us, but we'll get there.
Yeah. Well, if you go to CAG Podcasts on Facebook, we get the message a lot quicker. So at any rate, for Bound by Honor, I am Judge Him.
And I am Jorn.
And join us next time for the Klingon Book Review Podcast. Kapla! You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kurg Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!